welcome. You're tuned into the best at True Crime Talk Radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hello.
Hey, got to make a quick announcement for those of you following along on the Play It at Home version of Darkness Radio and the Holzer Files. Holzer Files has hit their mid-season break. Right now, Discovery Networks and Travel Channel are focused on launching their new Discovery Plus platform, streaming platform, as of January 4th. So a lot of their shows are going on a mid-season break and hiatus. Holzer Files is one of those. We will be returning, I believe it's early March. So we have 7 brand new episodes for you that'll be coming out. But this week there will be no Holzer Files on Travel Channel. I'm just giving you a heads up. But tune in. They've got other great programming and other things I think they're going to be plugging in that they have to satisfy before the end of this crazy year. So tune in and check out Travel Channel for those updates. And keep listening to the show for updates on when the Holzer Files will return. All right, Tim, I want to jump right into this. We've got a great guest joining us tonight. A new book, Requiem, my mouth isn't working as fluidly as I'd like it to. Requiem for a Female Serial Killer came out in November. And joining us on the show today is Phyllis Chesler. She is the author of this book. And Phyllis, thank you so much for joining us to discuss this book and a different look at a case people think they may know quite a bit about.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Now, just as a little bit of your background, you're a PhD and an emerita professor of psychology and women's studies at City University of New York. You're a best-selling author, a legendary feminist leader, a retired psychotherapist. So you've got quite an impressive background and pedigree as we go into this. I like our listeners to have a little bit of an understanding of who we're speaking with and why this case. But let's step into that. We're about to discuss Eileen Wuornos, which was famously portrayed by Charlize Theron in the movie Monster. And there's been documentary after documentary about this woman, but it's a story that should be looked at again, and perhaps in a different way and in a different light. Why did you feel, and how is your connection to this story different than maybe things we'd seen before?
I heard that the police were hunting for two women who were serial killers who were killing men in Florida. And I thought, oh, this is like the Orson Welles whimsical announcement about Martians have landed. It can't be real. And then they captured one of these women. So I took a look at it and I saw the themes that called out to me, namely how violent prostitution really is for the prostitute, and how male serial killers really kill. They prey upon women who are prostituted and girls and children. And I thought, and I'm sure, given the abuse that she must have endured in her lifetime, she must be a little crazy also, although I don't pathologize craziness in human beings. I look at it differently. So I was instantly interested in a political trial that would allow a jury to hear from pro bono experts, whom I gathered, about the realities of how dangerous a prostitute's life is and how it's possible that she could have killed in self-defense the first time, which is all the jury should have heard about. That's not how it worked out, though. So my interests were feminist, passionate politics, and I was a total idealist, and it didn't occur to me, and I'm glad I'm talking to true crime people, it literally didn't occur to me for a while that she could really be a serial killer, that she could really be a very unique kind of serial killer, which is something that I write about eventually in Requiem. So I was a do-gooder, enamored of my own goals and themes, and that's how I got involved.
When you said something a little earlier, I'd like to visit with for just a moment. You said that you don't pathologize crazy in people. What does that mean, and how do you define it? What is that to you?
Oh, good question. Well, when people are tortured, or when you have incest and violence, battering, and psychological and verbal humiliation in childhood, you can very well become someone who's super vigilant, who's insomniac, who has nightmares, who becomes paranoid, who can't leave that kind of setup because it's like a Stockholm syndrome setup. So battered girls will usually marry men who batter them, and they can't get out. So when I would meet such a person in either a professional capacity or as a teacher or a lecturer, I wouldn't necessarily say, that's it, case of mental illness. I would look at it as post-traumatic stress symptomatology, similar to what happens when men are in combat. And a brilliant psychiatrist, years after my first book, Women in Madness, came out, Dr. Judy Herman wrote a very important book called Trauma and Recovery, which details this and compares the symptomatology of men. She was looking at post-World War I with battered women or with torture victims. So that's what I meant. Now, that's not to say that some people don't have organic brain syndrome, or some people don't have all kinds of, quote, dirty genes that, if you abuse them, even if you don't, may then result in exceedingly dangerous behavior, including homicidal behavior. So it's a complicated area, and toward the end, I tried to persuade Eileen Wuornos to consider an insanity defense, because she's crazy. I mean, by then, with the alcohol and the abuse and her, what she was born with, I thought you could really at least live. They might not have to execute you. And she was very proud and very private and wouldn't consider it and didn't want anyone looking inside her head. And this is a woman who was already speaking in different voices as if she was a multiple personality. I don't know if she was, by the way. She had different personae.
Is that
the conversation?
Yes, it does. And I was going to say, does that is that kind of the dissociative behavior? Because when people deal with traumatic events, and I've been in very low level traumatic events where I feel like almost as though I've been thrown out of my body watching what happens, like your consciousness takes a break to let what is about to take place happen. And does that develop another personality? Does that develop another aspect of our individuality that might not always pop up in everybody else? But that, you know, that personality is what takes the brunt of that abuse or situation.
Absolutely. Now, when someone is being gang raped in a war zone, for example, where rape has become a weapon of war, not merely a spoil, or when a child is being raped by her father or grandfather or uncle or older brother, she'll dissociate. She'll leave her body as a way of enduring it. Now, whether or not she or he will then become a multiple personality, that's not necessarily always the case, but they might learn how to dissociate from painful situations. So, for example, when I asked Wuornos, how many times have you been raped? Her definition of rape is not my definition. And when she got to the 37th example, I could barely breathe. And I told her, and I said, I can't take anymore. And she goes, doesn't bother me, not at all. I'm fine. And I thought,
well,
yeah, I bet
you. Say that your definition of rape and hers are not the same. Can you maybe give us some unique insight into that then? And she said she's up to her 37th example before you finally say, I can't handle hearing anymore. What is
right.
that?
Like? Well, her definition, there are two definitions. The more shocking one to me was when a bunch of guys tie you up and tie you down and gang rape you and threaten to kill you and beat you badly. That's not my definition of rape, but it's hers. It was hers. And her other definition, very different, was a prostitute is being paid money to be raped. And if you don't pay her, that's like raping her then and stealing from her. I hadn't thought of that either. It was quite an education that I got.
Right. Well, let's go back. Well, you know, we're jumping kind of in the aftermath. Take me back into Eileen Wuornos's life. What can you tell us about her and her upbringing?
Oh, dear. She was born in Michigan in 1956, and her father, her biological father, Leo Pittman, was a pedophile who hung himself in jail. I don't think she ever met him. Her biological mother, Diane, whom I ultimately interviewed, was run out of town by her own maternal parents, by her mother and father, and they, the grandparents of Lee Wuornos and her brother Keith, adopted her. I'm not sure if it was a legal adoption, perhaps it was, but they presented themselves as her parents. Her grandmother didn't beat her, but she drank a great deal. Her grandfather beat her, and then horrendous neglect. For example, Wuornos couldn't really see well and couldn't hear that well. No corrections were made. She didn't get glasses. She didn't get a hearing aid in childhood. And she began having sex for food in the neighborhood while she was severely humiliated verbally by all the kids there, by the boys and the girls. And then an old man raped her and impregnated her when she was 14. And this was all on her. It was her shame that she brought to the family. She was forced into a home for unwed mothers. And then she had a son who she gave up to adoption. At that point, her sister, who's really her aunt, Lori, said that Lee had told her men really hate our guts. Now, that's an early feminist idea there, or analysis. And there are so many women who are birth mothers who never get over that. It's traumatizing, and the child also. So what happens next? She doesn't go to school. The police, the social workers, the good people of her town, of the state of Michigan, they don't step in to rescue her. There's no adult in the room. So she hits the road by herself and decided, I'm out of here. I'm going to live loud and live large and go south where it's warmer. And as she was on the highway selling sex to survive, blonde, pretty, young teenager, a child, she manages to get herself arrested and jailed for disorderly conduct, once for firing a pistol from a moving vehicle, another time for assault in a bar and disturbing the peace. And she marries briefly. But the man she married, much older than herself, who was wealthy, she said, he took out a restraining order against her. So we're already looking at a woman, a child, with a bad temper, who's not on any medication to cool her down other than beer, and who's on her own and at the mercy of John after John, trucker after trucker. And she learns to hold her own, and she learns to punch up, which is most unusual. So rather than cower and take a beating, she'll try to give as good as she gets. That's unusual for a woman. And then she finally gets to Florida and has a series. What I do in Requiem is I have to imagine some of it because she would never describe the murders. And I had to imagine her various arrests, her brushes with the law from her point of view. From her point of view, nothing went her way. She never got a break. It didn't mean to happen this way, and then it did, and she couldn't stop it. Poor me. And she really cognitively didn't get the rules of civilization. She was outside civilization. So let me stop for a little bit. What do you think of this in terms of Michigan's responsibility for what
happened? Obviously, ultimately? you see this, and you hate to limit it by compartmentalizing something and saying that somebody slipped through the cracks. But in this case, you see how people are lost on a daily basis because there aren't proper protocols in place for mental health, for law and understanding of what's taking place in a person's life, and for seeing the fractured issues that people are dealing with. So she was sadly, and again, it sounds minimalistic, but she was somebody that slipped through the cracks of society and developed her own perception of what life was. That's something, thankfully, most of us will never have to confront.
Yes, yes. She was like a child. And at the first trial, the defense attorney did have a local psychologist, two of them, in fact, who talked about how primitive she was. And that means she needed money for the next day or two. She needed money for food and for rent in a motel. That was it. And for music, the jukebox for music, loud because she couldn't hear. And she didn't have a car in Florida. And that struck me because everyone has a car in Florida except the very low down, beaten down people who may have not only no money, but they have outstanding warrants for their arrest, so they can't legally get a driver's license and don't know a way around it. So she would walk and take the bus. And then on the bus, she would fight with every bus driver. She would fight with all of the passengers. Obviously, this is, I know it's not politically correct for me as a feminist to say this, but she was mentally ill and needed help and certainly didn't accept it. Certainly it wasn't offered. Certainly her life up to that point, up to the first time she was in jail for about a year and a half, nobody helped her out. I mean, she had a point. Nobody helped me out. And she didn't know the rule. She really didn't understand when she was arrested. And there's a videotape of her confession. It's so poignant because she's detoxing. She has no beer. And she doesn't know for sure if all the cops interviewing her are lawyers or are Johns or are her friends, and whether she can talk her way out of it or not. And she finally says, I guess get me a lawyer, at which point everything should have stopped. But what these wily cops did was offer her a cigarette, offer to get her coffee, you know, as if it was just a conversation among friends. And so because the cops had gotten her lover to trap her, to trick her, to tell her that they were all over the lover and they were going to arrest her for something that the lover had not done, which is true. That is why she confessed. She was a fool for love, is how I saw it. And she confessed to save this woman who was bringing her down and who took the stand against her. And the jury in the first case should only have heard the details of the first murder. And they also should have heard something about who she murdered. This was a guy who's a whoremaster.
Wait, 1 second. Can we go back and then we'll go forward?
Yes.
I want to unpack a little bit about what you just said. So she's believed to be there for one reason. Isn't this a sense of entrapment to be told that this is what's going on and that she steps up to take the hit for a crime that this lover didn't commit? There just seems something inherently wrong with the law that was the tack taken in order to get this woman.
Well, you're right, but it was Worse than that, the cops were negotiating with the lover, Tyria was her name, not at all like the Christina Ricci figure in the movie Monster, because I interviewed the real Tyria at great length years later. The cops were making movie deals before they captured her, using their control over Tyria. Now, two of them were reprimanded in some way at some point. One was let go, or one retired early. But this is what obsessed Lee Wuornos. Not to save her life. No, that was of not great interest. The crooked cops. It became an obsession with her. Certainly all the years on death row. Get the crooked cops. Expose them. Get the crooked cops. And, well, she had a point. I mean, what they did was entrap the lover by saying, look, you were with her, you ditched the car, you knew about the murders, you didn't come forward, we're going to hold you accountable. They had a point. If you do not help us, get her. So they flew her down or drove her down to Florida, put her up in a motel, and the conversations between them were recorded, and I've read them. And they're also very moving because Lee keeps saying, I love you. Tyria says, yeah. Lee says, I didn't do anything. You didn't do anything. And then Tyria says, listen, they're after me. They're going to arrest me. They have my family. My life is over. I didn't do anything. And after enough of these pre-scripted conversations, probably not illegal, highly immoral, Lee says, okay, that's it. I'll tell them what happened. But, you know, for a serial killer, she was not strategic. I mean, they could have found her sooner. She pawned things nearby. She threw things away that could be found and were found. So she's not like a Ted Bundy with craft and guile and pre-planning and a particular kind of target for erotic purposes. No, she was totally different than that.
She was in the moment. And
well,
is that not it?
She was, but that's not what the murders were about. I think the first murder, I have no doubt, and this was her story until years later, she recanted her own story, but I think that was false, a false recantation. This guy, Richard Mallory, was into pornography big time. He was into prostitutes big time. He was a sex addict who actually, very oddly, did many years in a facility for attempted rape. And he was a white guy, so that's unusual to happen so many years for that. He must have picked the wrong man's daughter or wife. And see, he was, and there was a former girlfriend of his who wanted to testify to have the jury understand that it was probably very likely that he got rough with her, he got mean with her, and he certainly would try to get away without paying anything. And her name was Jackie Davis. She was not allowed to testify. The reasoning being, dead man's not on trial. You know, but there's probably ways to present to a jury a similar fact pattern. It never happened. I was urging her public defender to follow that line. I may not have been the only one to do so, but that didn't happen. And so her story, which I retell in Requiem, and which she was on the stand, I think, with great credibility describing it, with the dignity, not believed, you know. She talked about how he picked her up, and everything was fine, and she revealed she was a prostitute, and he said, oh, I thought we'd get it on, but I didn't know that you're in the business. They discussed a fee, and then suddenly everything switched. He tied her to the steering wheel. She was stripped. He wasn't, and he really tortured her. and she thought he was going to kill her for sure because he was threatening to do that. And she had a gun because some of her Johns were either military men or police officers. And someone, a man looking out for her, said, you know, you ought to have a gun. I mean, you're in a dangerous business. And so she got a gun. And somehow, lightning swift, she was able to, at a certain moment, reach down, get her gun, and shoot him. And he kept coming at her. He didn't back away. He didn't run away. So she had to keep shooting him. And as she said, what am I going to do? I can't see that well. I aimed for his legs. He kept coming. And afterwards, she did something that no male serial killer, to my knowledge, has ever done. She didn't want to leave his corpse exposed, so she covered him with a blanket from the car and then drove the hell out of there and broke down, drinking, crying. But after that, what was she going to do? Go to the police? Police tend not to believe prostitutes. And in general, our justice system views battered women who kill finally in self-defense when no one else has come to their aid, they get pretty long sentences. And they're viewed with distrust by female as well as male jurors. So from Lee Warnos' point of view, she just had to get back to work and drown her sorrows in even more beer. Anyway.
Boy, that's tragic. And you know, just so people do understand, though, you paint the picture of the victim, the man she murdered. And it isn't to say, well, he was worthy of death. He was worthy of this, worthy of that, because this whole thing should not have happened. But it's important. The jury should have known what she was up against, who she was dealing with, and the full nature of her situation.
I thought so.
And that was not presented. What was the reasoning, especially with prosecution coming at her that way? Your defense, you would figure, is trying to hold up every aspect. Or it doesn't matter, she's some dirty whore. Let's just, you know, I have to present her because that's my job as a district attorney. So it's minimal effort. What is the insight to that?
Well, her prosecutor, John Tanner, was Ted Bundy's spiritual advisor. Tanner,
what?
Yes, had a born-again Christian moment and left a lucrative private practice to become a public prosecutor. And the media was filled. Her lawyer asked, her public defender asked, to be removed to Miami, not to stay in Marion County in Ocala, which is very north central Florida, kind of redneck territory, where women were under the gun for joining the National Organization for Women. And she was seen not just as a dirty whore. Oh, no. She was the dyke dirty whore who was killing good white men. So what kind of jury of her peers do you imagine she got?
Well, they're not going to find her peers, that's for sure.
Absolutely. And there were no peers. There were some people who thought prostitution should be legal. That means let's legalize violence against women even further. Let's sexually objectify them even further. Let's make it legal and give the government a piece of the take. And so the jury were local people who wouldn't look kindly, who didn't know, who couldn't possibly understand the territory she operated in or the trajectory of her life. Even if they heard, oh, she was abused as a child. Well, who isn't? You know, doesn't make everybody a serial killer. Okay, so you've been abused. It doesn't mean you have to go and abuse your kid or abuse everyone else, you know, which is fair enough as a challenge.
Right.
But the trial, had I been able to raise some money. I had a lawyer, a private lawyer, who would have tried very hard to handle this as a political trial, which it should have been. But I got Lyme's disease, and that laid me so low, and nobody took my place. And the interesting, if not tragic thing, is that Warnos herself really couldn't comprehend someone like me and the other feminists who I pulled in doing something for nothing. This is very foreign to her. So I'm ostensibly interested in overthrowing the system, and she just wants a piece of the pie. She's a capitalist, a mini bourgeois capitalist. And she became, as I now understand, many serial killers. She was not just obsessed about the corrupt cops and the jurors and the no justice in the trial, but with her fame, she said, "I've made history," quote unquote. "I'm in the history books," quote unquote. And she wanted to make money by telling her story, or having others tell her story, or having others function as agents for her or writers for her. She didn't comprehend that she's going to be on death row until they execute her. And she can't get much of the money. That's just yet another example of how, even though she was smart and a survivor and drew beautifully, there were pieces missing in her brain.
Yeah. It's hard to talk about cases like this because you see failure on so many different levels. And you wonder, well, God, this woman was a horror show. She was, but you look at the things she had to endure in her life. And at what level do we start to examine the culpability of society around a person like this and why they're not helped, right? Because if I believe this, I can't remember the name of the law. I want to say it's the Samaritan law, but I know that's not the right term. If I stood there watching you drown and I had the tools near me to help and I didn't, I can be held responsible for your death. Why is there not more culpability held on the case of organizations and things like that for letting people like this end up in this kind of situation?
Well, there should be, but as we know, there is not. And even now, most people aren't up in arms about the invisible scapegoats that prostitutes are, about the trafficking of children into prostitution and the tracking of them in terms of home lives that are highly dysfunctional, very dangerous, very sexualized, filled with beatings, and when the 9-year-old or the 10-year-old runs away, she or he will get tracked into prostitution, and there's no exit. There's no exit. And where it's legal, like in Nevada, it's an even worse case scenario because the women are literally worked around the clock almost, and they're behind bars, and nobody gets rich. That's another myth. Oh, well, they choose to do it. It's voluntary, and they're getting rich. They need the money. Well, you don't get rich. The pimps, the landlords, perhaps the police on the payroll get rich, but not the working girl. And I had so naively hoped that a jury would get to hear about this. There are some former prostitutes who are survivors who've attempted and who've succeeded in opening up shelters for other prostitutes who want to get out. And it's a huge undertaking that should be, I hesitate to say it should be in the government's hands because that doesn't work so well. Let's just say we should have them, and we don't. So, whatever studies exist confirm that it's a myth that if you have legal prostitution or then non-prostituted women don't get raped. It's not true. Plus, right. Why why on my watch would I be happy that I'm not getting raped, but some other woman is, only to throwing her a few nickels for the act. So you're right. There should be more understanding of this. And more than that, the society, we the people, should have stepped up a long time ago to end this. I'm an abolitionist. I think this is sex slavery. And yes, I'm not against a woman, if she is over 21, if she has absolutely no other economic option and no skill and has to eat, and if this is what she chooses to do, or this is what she has to do. And I'm thinking of many, many third world and fourth world countries. I'm not going to stigmatize her. I would say, gee, I wish she had more of an education. I wish she had more of employment opportunities. I wish everyone had, you know, child care so you could go to work, and so on. So this is a world, our world, which is in need of such repair. And there's so much repairing that needs to be done.
We hear about the first murder, which is horrific in nature, and you can see how somebody could be pushed to murder, and that there was remorse afterwards, that this wasn't something, but there was also fear and realization that she was not probably going to be treated right. So you could almost understand why she would evade, but six people in total, correct? Isn't that how they broke it down?
Seven.
It would be seven people.
Seven men, middle-aged, yeah. White men.
How did it play out from that point forward?
Well, in my opinion, because Requiem for a Female Serial Killer is a genre blend, like In Cold Blood, if you will, I had to imagine certain things. I had to put myself in her place. What happened after that, I think, is this, or might be this. If a guy who said, I'll pay you for sex, I want this or that, suddenly wanted something she didn't want to do or got too rough with her, she might have killed him for that reason. And because she needed whatever money might be in the car that he was going to be withholding from her, because if he got rough with her, who knows what's going to happen next. Then there's something else. In other instances, two of the men she killed, one was a former police officer, one was a current police officer. And every prostituted girl and woman has an experience of a police person or a man with a badge, phony perhaps, saying, okay, you're going to do what I want and I'm not paying you, and if you don't, I'm arresting you. So these two guys, she shot in the head. Execution style. I suspect it's possible that they may have said, okay, sex, my terms, no money for you. And she didn't want to take that anymore. And then there's a third possibility. And I imagine all of this throughout her season of the year of the murders. What if a guy, friendly, good Samaritan, stops, there she is, a woman alone, not tarted up, she's wearing plain clothes, no makeup. That was her disguise to pass for normal, by the way. And he said, okay, I'll give you a lift, but no, I'm not interested in sex. And that, and there were two men who escaped from her. They got scared because she got really angry when they said, no, I'm not interested. I'm with my wife. I'm happy. So it could be also that one or two of these murders involved men who said, you know what, I know that you are hungry and you want to eat, and I have a house and children and grandchildren and credit cards, I'm fine, but I'm not giving you any of my money. And that disparity, that cruel economic disparity, could have led to, that's it, I'm blowing you away. Her own personal affirmative action program, if you will. Now, she would never talk to anybody about the murders themselves, except the first one. Thereafter, she couldn't give herself, she didn't know how to help herself. She sabotaged everything. She hired the worst lawyer in Florida who finally admitted he didn't know what he was doing and he did everything wrong, to she didn't want to plead one way or the other going forward because she saw what the jury would be like, what the judge was like. She didn't want any more of it. She said, that's it. I'm ready to die. Kill me. It's over. And she didn't understand that the very state that has the power to arrest you and try you can take their time about executing you. So, like many others, she was on death row for about a decade, going crazier and crazier, becoming, you said remorse before.
Well, you said that she cried afterwards. She was upset. She, to me, that seems like a sense of remorse for dealing with it. Maybe I'm giving too much credit.
I don't think when you're in a fight for your life and you don't die, but you have to kill to save your life, you're sorry that it happened that way, but you may not feel remorse about having to save your life. She became a serious Christian on death row. Many do. And would from time to time say, yeah, I'm really sorry, you know, God forgive me, I shouldn't have done it. But I didn't experience a deep level of conscious remorse. It could be, you know, my...
Okay. It was more just like the shock and awe of what she did and having survived it herself.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's the sobbing and the emotionality and the drinking. And,
right.
and she confessed it to Tyria, who indeed didn't at first believe her. And then eventually, as she kept coming home with cash and with cars that she'd have to ditch and with stories about where the cars were from, a boyfriend of John, you know, and then she'd have to give it back. Tyria probably should have gone to the police. I think over time, she became increasingly frightened for what might happen to her, frightened by what Lee had done and how this would all turn out. So when I said she's a unique serial killer, it took me a while to profile her, because first I wasn't thinking of her as a killer. I was thinking of her as a prostitute wronged and as a symbol of prostitution writ large and a woman's right to kill in self-defense. Here's what I finally came up with, and it's in the last chapter of Requiem. You have girls, boys, but definitely girls who are as badly abused as she was. They do not become serial killers. They unfortunately choose a life circumstance as adults that resembles in ways their childhood. Then you have female serial killers. They're not like her. Black widows who mainly kill husband after husband for money, or female and sometimes male nurses who kill patient after patient, sometimes for money and sometimes just because they can. Now we have male serial killers. I'm sure you know more than I know about them, but they, well, the sadistic ones, male serial killers prey on women, vulnerable, mainly prostitutes, because nobody cares when they disappear. Nobody even comes looking for them. And in America today, that's largely women of color and children of color. And you never heard anybody marching about this, but they should. So, and often they will pose their prey, their dismembered prey, in these grotesque gynecological positions,
right,
as if it's a statement, Jack the Ripper style, a statement of triumph over womankind. And it's for sex. There's some sexual release. Warn us, no sexual release. Didn't target men because she wanted sex with them. Did her usual, she wants money, and she'll give them sex for money. She didn't pose them. In a few instances, not just the first, she hid their bodies. So she's kind of unique. I don't know if there is another female serial killer like her. And totally non-strategic, totally disorganized, totally impromptu. And as I said before, the police, if they looked, they could have found her sooner. If they believed that this could be done by a woman, by a mere woman, maybe they could have found her sooner.
You know, the movie Monster, is that a fair assessment of this woman, or at least what she became?
No, but Charlize Theron is a great actress, and she did a brilliant impersonation of her body language. Perhaps, and there was a certain amount of sympathy for Lee's hard life, you know, in childhood. This was an impersonation. It was not an interior description. I mean, Lee would...
This was a depiction of how the media portrayed her more than who she was as a human.
Yes. And it portrayed her even more sympathetically than she really was. As in, she had personae. There was Cammy Green, the Marine, which is one of the names she left when she pawned some of the ill-gotten gains. And she would order me, military style, "You get those cops," and she'd be scary. And then there would be other voices. Now, again, I'm not saying she was a multiple personality or that the way she had to dissociate from awful realities in her life, you know, led her to be a multiple personality. But she was scattered. She was passionate. She was angry. She was not a cool customer like Ted Bundy. Totally not. And it remains a bit of a mystery how she continued on and continued to kill. It's unusual. I mean, as I said, women kill intimates, not strangers. And she also, and I write about it in Requiem, she would never back down from a fight. She would start a fight with everyone, with anybody.
And do you think she was looking for a way out, or is that too simplistic? Was she just hoping that by crossing the wrong person, at some point she was just going to be killed? So it was almost like suicide by cop, in the sense of putting yourself in these undesirable positions time after time, just waiting for somebody to end your misery.
That's an interesting idea. I don't know. I think she wanted to keep going, but she didn't want to be hassled anymore. Maybe she had reached her maximum of what she could take, of what a human being can take. You know, she was Thelma and Louise before Thelma and Louise. She hit the ground running. And since then, in the movies alone, not just in Monster, there are so many movies that show us female assassins, female FBI agents, female crooked characters, you know, who are killers, all kinds of killers, right? Trained, untrained, spies. She was on her own. She didn't have literature or movies to give her an idea of what she could do or what she had to do. She was a total original and doomed and damned. And interestingly enough, and this is in the very end of Requiem, and I called it Requiem because I wanted to lay her to rest with some gravity and some dignity. And many years had passed before I could do this. She, at the very end, and I'm looking it up, I'm opening the book, she wanted to be buried with a cross, wearing a cross necklace with a Bible under her arm, with a white T-shirt with Christ on it, earrings that are cross in her hands. So this is how I think she wanted to be received in heaven. But what she wanted to also go out as a shit-kicking mercenary, someone who was going out as a renegade at war with the ruling classes.
She saw herself as the hero of her own story.
Oh, well, she hung out with bikers. And so she wanted to be dressed in a black Harley Davidson t-shirt, biker-style boots, and a military belt. Now, of course, how could you be wearing white and wearing that? Not clear to me, but that's what she said she wanted. And she has quite a cult following, which amazed me. But she's seen as someone who fought against the superiors and became famous. That seems to be a big currency in our country now. So she's all these different people. She's a religious Christian. She's a biker outlaw. She's a Marine. And she's a much sinned against child, a happy-go-lucky hooker, a wheeler dealer, and a very secretive serial killer. Kept secrets, took them to the grave with her.
Do you believe that there are more than the seven that we know about?
Possible. But how could they not have found the bodies? How could no one have reported? It's one thing if you're prostituted and you disappear, no one cares. And the police don't usually care or do much about it. So these would be white men, middle-aged. Somebody would care. So no one's come forward. There's one case where a body was never found, and she may or may not have been guilty, might have been guilty. So it's possible there are more, yes. Yes. This is, I say that like the late, great Anne Rule, I'm also haunted by my time with a serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my way of finally laying her to rest. And it's a dirge of sorts because I'm mourning what can happen to a girl in this world, a horrifying and pitiful tale with an inevitably sordid ending. And then I talk about her of complexity and a contrarian. I mean, she took on some of the guys she killed were a foot taller than her. She wasn't that big. So I mean, I couldn't do it, but didn't stop her.
When you spoke with her lover, what was that like? I mean, what was her concept of all of this? Was she just caught up in this whirlwind? Was she getting off on everything as well? What do we know about that aspect of the story?
So different than the Christina Ricci character, night and day. She was the toughest, most butch lesbian I ever met in my entire life. And she was closed-mouthed and, in a way, straight. She came from a large family, and they supported her, her so-called lifestyle. And she was kind of rural farmer's daughter. And her working skills, she cleaned motel rooms. She didn't have a lot of skills. But her story was that she begged Lee not to continue being a hooker. She said she offered to work three jobs if she would only give up that life. Lee said, ha, not so. Lee said that she'd like to just lay around, drink beer, smoke cigarettes, and she wanted to make sure that I had enough money to keep the whole operation going for food, for beer, and for the motel rooms. At the end of the day, I didn't know who to believe. I really didn't.
Did you find Eileen redeemable?
Well, good question. It was very late in the day for her. But if there was psychiatric medication, I mean, she must have had organic brain syndrome or a traumatic brain injury. And if she could have glasses or have her vision corrected, and if she could have hearing aids, and if she had some kind of psychiatric medication that could help her get off drinking so much to medicate her reality and to deal with how she can't think straight, and to then, let's take it further, and this is a complete utopian idea, and who would listen to her, but she'd need medication because she would be wildly, she would not have the attentional focus. She wouldn't have attention. She would move from subject to subject. So to calm her down and to depress the rage stored up in her, I think you would need medication for that. And then you'd need a lot of time and a lot of loving care. And even then, I don't know whether she could be out in civilization safely. And I say that with great sorrow.
Do you believe that she shouldn't have been put to death for these crimes?
I do. I wanted her. I tried to persuade her to consider an insanity plea. I said, trust me, you would qualify. And she was offended by the idea. And maybe she was smarter than me, because she knew they'd never let her out of a mental asylum and that they'd drug her up so that she would have no reality left and might become a freak or a laughingstock. So I think the death penalty is a pressing issue. I oppose it, but then I pause and I think, well, what about child rapists who cannot be redeemed? What about serial killers, male serial killers, like Bundy or like the Florida guy, Gerald Stano, who, you know, spent years killing prostitutes, mainly black prostitutes in Florida? I don't know. Should we kill them or not? Devil's Island, perhaps, somewhere, float them out somewhere where they can not harm people. I don't like the death penalty. Because it makes we the people into murderers, doesn't it?
I've seesaw back and forth on this topic constantly, having had a friend that was brutally murdered and two of her children. My first cry was for justice, and I just hope the minute they found him guilty, they'd drag the three animals out and shoot him in the head and leave him there. But then that's kind of the knee jerk, and you think, you know, people like this that are this evil, should they get a chance at redemption? Should they be alive on the taxpayer's dollar?
Right.
And then where do we run into judgment? When do we get to decide enough's enough? I don't know. The empathetic part of me thinks, no, that makes us just as bad. It makes us a killer. But then, you know, there's the other aspects that are like, at what point does justice get served? And yeah, I know if you're religious, you believe it comes in the afterlife. Unfortunately, that doesn't placate the people now that want to see that people cannot do this and get away with it.
That's true. I'm with you on the seesaw. There are anti-death penalty absolutists and fundamentalists. I'm not that. Although in general, are we saying that we would rather warehouse for the rest of their lives, limited lives, no quality of life, and pay for it? So we're doing slow kind of torture that we're paying for, and they're not being rehabilitated, they're not being redeemed. Is this the thing that we stand for? Or is it likely that a pedophile who cannot be corrected can't? Do we want to pay for him to live behind bars or kill him? I'm talking about pedophiles who kill children.
Right.
How much can society afford to risk, and how much can society afford to pay economically? And do we really want to have the for-profit prisons speak for us? Do we really want to just imprison as many as we can find, some of whom are redeemable, some of whom have not committed heinous crimes? These are burning questions.
What was your biggest takeaway, Phyllis, from having a rarefied moment to be able to speak with this woman, this murderer? What is your biggest takeaway and what you hope people will get from your book?
Well, we had a correspondence, and I have one chapter in the book which shares some of the correspondence. And we had many phone conversations. And I met her when she was already on death row. I didn't meet her before then. One big takeaway is how naive I was in thinking I could save her, and that justice might prevail, and that if only the truth would be told, then juries would understand. So that's one big takeaway, that I was reluctant to say, oh, I am dealing with a serial killer. Wait, watch your back. You know, pay attention. That took a while to develop. The second big takeaway was what a poor, damaged child she was, a child woman. And I had more compassion for her, not less. I was wrenched with compassion for her. Another big takeaway was initially, like her fans, I saw her as doing something that most women wouldn't dare imagine doing. I mean, to the worst of men, to the worst. And then I came to understand she's not my cult figure. She's not my hero. She's a sinned against child who didn't get any justice along the way and who was born bad as well as turned bad. Three takeaways.
It's a compelling book. It's a fascinating look at the story that people think they know. Requiem for a Female Serial Killer. We have a link for it on today's program so that you can see it for yourself. Buy it, read it, go a little deeper into this. You walk a very interesting line throughout this book and throughout this interview, Phyllis, that I appreciate. The line of being honest to the story, but not glorifying the people involved. And it's a tough line to walk, but I think you do it very eloquently.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming on and sharing with us. And it's fascinating. I don't, sometimes you think I'd like to be able to sit down with these killers to just try to understand. And that's something I've wanted for years since the death of my friend. But I don't know that I'm the guy for that, but I'm glad that there are people like you that have taken that step to look into the eyes of the abyss and come back with a story to share that can be non-judgmental. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Have a safe and happy holidays, and we appreciate you stopping in and spending some time with us today.
My pleasure to you and to your listeners.
All right, kids. It's here, the time you've been waiting for. We're going to kick open the case files. We've got dumb crimes and stupid criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
Before we jump into Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals, though, Tim, I do think I should mention that, it is Tuesday, True Crime Tuesday, but yesterday we released on social media links to one of our favorite episodes, which deals with true crime.
Mm-hmm.
From 2007. It is a look at the murder of John Lennon.
Yes.
And this is an episode that we always feature as one of our favorites because it is so unusual and weird. And today, unfortunately, December 8th marks, the 40th or so anniversary of the assassination of John Lennon? 40 years.
Yes, it's hard to 40 years, yeah. 1980.
I remember watching Monday Night Football that night. And I'm not a football guy,
mm-hmm.
but I remember walking in and when Howard Cosell made that announcement.
Yeah.
I just remember, I was like, what? No. What? And I remember my mom crying. I remember my aunt crying. It was such a weird time. And at that point, I was a Monkees fan, straight up, pure and simple. You know, I grew up with it on TV all the time. I liked the Beatles fine. You know, I heard their music, but I just wasn't an aficionado of their catalog. it certainly struck me as I got older, but man, what a crazy ass story. We delve into the story from a person who was very close with Mark David Chapman, the assassin of John Lennon, to hear a different aspect of his story. And one of the chilling aspects of this is Maria Simpson. She was going under an assumed name because she didn't want to be bothered. I threw something at her during this interview that, from what I've understood since, removed her from ever talking about this case really openly again, because it was a holy shit moment for her that made her blood run a little cold. You know what part I'm talking about.
Yep. Yep.
I don't want to give it away, but you know, as you just heard in tonight's interview, as I talk to them, sometimes I say, you know, I question. When I talked about Eileen Wuornos, I said, do you think maybe this was her suicide pact? She did these things escalating, hoping to eventually be just taken out. And you heard Phyllis say, you know, that's an interesting take. And I heard this interview with Maria and Chip Coffee at the time, and it was compelling, and there were some aspects. And then one part of the story stood out to me, and I questioned her about it. And it, you can hear it in her voice at the moment. You hear this, like the record skip and the wheels clutch, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you could just hear her having this realization moment. And it was weird, but it's one of my favorite episodes. It is, if you go to our social media, Facebook, Twitter, you'll see the links for it. We posted it on Monday, and it should be near the top of the pages. But you can go in and check that out for yourself. And it was the it's called The Possession of Mark David Chapman. And the links are up in our regular Darkness Radio archives, which are free. They have ads in them. Or you're already a subscriber to Stitcher Premium because you're getting this show. You can get the commercial-free, ad-free version of this episode. And it originally aired, I want to say, February 11th, 2007. So that should help you scroll through the archives, or you can easily find, I put up a link for hour one and hour two, so you could go check it and see for yourself. But it's a great episode. And if you like true crime and you like our paranormal slant from time to time, I believe that's one that you should definitely examine. Does that still go down for you as one of your favorite unusual episodes?
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely. That, you know, I was so fascinated by that story as a youngster. And you know, one of my favorite albums of... You're going to think this is odd. As a kid, was that Double Fantasy album. That John Lennon Double Fantasy album. And I think I listened to it with a morbid curiosity. I would listen to it thinking, you know, did John really realize that this was going to be the last album that he would ever make? And you, when you listen to it with that morbid curiosity of, you know, this was really going to be his last moments in a recording studio and the last thing that he would ever put on wax. It does have a haunting quality to it. You know, just like Starting Over, and that song in itself gives you chills when you listen to it. You know, the reverb in the song really has a haunting quality to it. You know, the words, our life together is so precious together, you know, those words alone bring chills when you start listening to that song and thinking, you know, man, you know, you think you don't have that long, man. When from that time in the studio when he sang that to the time where he has that fateful day with Mark David Chapman.
I've got a piece of audio I'm going to have Tim play now. This is John Lennon reading a letter predicting his assassination.
Dear Mr. Lennon, from information I received while using a Ouija board, I believe that there will be an attempt to assassinate you. The spirit that gave me this information was Brian Epstein. He said the attempt would be made in place of March 6th, 17th. Mr. Epstein also said that Paul McCartney was alive in London. Is that true? Please take this letter seriously, because I would very much prefer you to be alive in it. It's funny you never said that to me in Athens.
That's chilling, right? I mean, you can hear the uncomfortable giggling from Yoko and John, kind of, haha. But, you know, that they make a claim, this person writes to them that they got a message through a Ouija board from who they believed was Brian Epstein, their former manager of the Beatles, stating he's going to be assassinated.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a chilling piece of audio. It's up on the today's episode. And I'll tell you what, we'll also include the link to the full video of this on today's program so that you can play it there as well and see the video. This isn't somebody imitating John Lennon. This is his actual moment reading the story. Very strange stuff. All right, let's go to happier, weirder topics. Let's go to dumb crimes, stupid criminals, Tim.
Okay.
Tire thief. That's our first one, Tim. First up. From, of all places, Milwaukee, Tim.
Okay.
It's a foul move, Tim. Foul move. There's a little clue for you.
Okay.
A suspect stole a Milwaukee man's car last Monday and left the vehicle propped atop a frozen turkey. I've never seen anything like this before, the victim told Fox 6 News. I've heard of people putting bricks, but I've never heard of a turkey being placed underneath. The man said he discovered the tire theft as he was getting ready to leave for work. I hope you enjoy that tire because you could have gave that turkey to somebody who really needed it. The man addressing the tire thief told the news outlet. He said he filed a police report and expects it will cost him around $600 for the repair. It is so weird. You just, the car is propped up on a frozen turkey. Do you think there was some guilt involved? The guy's like, I don't have money to buy a new tire. I will give them something. I don't, am I giving too much credit?
I think he might be. Yeah. And it might have just been the closest thing the guy had to prop the car up.
What do you mean, closest thing? What do you just walk around with a frozen turkey?
Well, you know, it's a holiday season. You might have just, you know.
Listen, I want to, before I read the next story, I want to also make a mention. I have HBO Max. I love it. A lot of cool movies, documentaries, things on there. Two documentaries, one about Heaven's Gate, what you think you know is challenged. You should watch the documentary. I think it's a 4-part documentary. Each is about an hour or a little over. But it's really compelling, the UFO cult. But you read the story and it's fascinating. Then there's one called The Vow, which is about NXIVM. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, Tim, you and I worked for a company in Minnesota called Peak Performers Network.
Yep.
Where we worked in helping to introduce people to motivational speakers.
Yep.
And when I started watching The Vow, I was like, I watched the first episode and I thought, I said this to myself when it ended. I said, oh shit, I could have easily become a member of that cult. No doubt in my mind. I could have become a member of that cult because what he's touting, the claims he's making, the things he's showing are remarkable. And it's, you know, a lot of it's not new, but it was in a really interesting way that he put it all together. Plus the pedigree. He was one of the three top scoring people in the world on intelligence tests. He was a concert level pianist. He had, I believe, three doctorates in three different things. He actually, his science that he created for making your life better is considered an actual science. It's been patented. That, you see those kind of credentials and you're like, hell yeah, I can understand how somebody could fall into a cult like this. Then you watch it de-evolve over the period of the rest of the episode. I think it's 8 or 9 episodes. And I thought, this is a great, compelling documentary. And I am telling you, I'm reaching out right now. I've already been, I've gotten a response from somebody integral to the story who is interested in talking, but they're really tied up right now. There's another documentary on Stars. It is called Seduced, and it is India Oxenberg's story. Now, in The Vow, throughout this, you see the different characters, and one of the people that they're trying to save is India Oxenberg, the daughter of famed actress Catherine Oxenberg.
Mm-hmm.
And you see to what levels Catherine goes in the vow to get her daughter, to try to free her daughter from this cult.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But how do you free somebody that doesn't see a problem in what they're doing?
Right.
And it's so bizarre, but I watched, I think people should watch The Vow first, because it's a really comprehensive, compelling story, but then watch Seduced, because it strips back even more of the veneer and goes right to the throat of Nexium and this Keith Raniere. And she pulls no punches. This is India's story. And holy hoppenstance. Man, what a crazy story. This is one I want to talk about on the show. So I'm working really hard to get a guest on here with us to discuss this.
Okay.
And if the guest I'm trying to get comes through, I'm just going to let our listeners know, I'm going to make it cross-platform. It'll be available on Darkness Radio and on True Crime Tuesday. But you True Crime Tuesday subscribers are going to get the ad-free content, and you'll get the Dumb Crime Stupid Criminal element. But this story is so big that I feel I want more people to hear about this.
Yeah.
So I want it to also go to our Darkness Radio audience. They'll only be able to hear it with the commercial versions and no Dumb Crime Stupid Criminal. So you still get an element of the show nobody else will get by being a subscriber. So I just wanted to put that out there. I got an email from Doc Ketchmark questioning you, Tim, about this next case.
Okay.
A giant penis sculpture has disappeared from a German mountaintop, and he'd like access to your backyard, Tim.
I bet he does.
Wants to see if you know where this 2-meter-tall wooden phallus has vanished off to, Tim. He thinks you might be the perpetrator.
I bet Doc would love to see my backyard.
I bet, especially with a 2-meter phallus.
Yeah.
Police in South Germany are investigating the mysterious disappearance of a giant wooden phallic sculpture that, until recently, took pride of place on a mountain summit in Bavaria.
Hmm.
The sculpture was removed from Grunten Mountain at some point this weekend, local newspaper Allgäuer Zeitung reported, with only a stump and sawdust left in its place. Well, that does happen with age.
Yeah.
The 2-meter-tall statue appears just as mysteriously several years ago. No artist has ever claimed it. Although it has no official name, the sculpture has been christened the Hole's Penis and has been become a local landmark and destination for hikers. It's even listed as a cultural monument on Google Maps. Police in a nearby Bavarian town of Kempten said a formal inquiry into the statue going missing had been opened, but it wasn't entirely clear that a crime had actually been committed. We don't know whether it is a criminal offense or not, a police spokesperson told Allgäuer Zeitung. The penis's statue appearance comes days after a mysterious metal monolith found in the desert in Utah similarly vanished, only for a new monolith to apparently emerge in Romania. So penises and monoliths appearing and disappearing, Tim. It's like they go in and out and in and out and in and out of all these different countries.
Uh-huh,
so,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
Let's just put it this way, Dave. Mysteriously, there was a new entry in the soapbox derby here in my neighborhood.
What's there? Was it a giant 2-meter-long wooden phallus?
Yeah, with wheels. And it aerodynamically won the race.
Nice.
Yeah, well, go figure. Flesh color. Yeah. It was an odd color, but it won.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, go figure.
A bald man has been busted at a hair salon, Tim.
Why?
A bald Kentucky man caused a disturbance at a salon after he asked a worker if she had a product to bring his hair back, and she told him no, according to police who busted the chrome-domed invader. Wow. That would be my superhero name, the chrome-domed invader.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Jeffrey Trent, 46, was arrested late after allegedly causing a disturbance inside a salon in Lawrenceburg, a city 25 miles west of Lexington. As detailed in a court citation, the 6'3", 250-pound Trent walked into Frame Clinic and Gallery around 10:40 a.m. and asked about a product to bring his hair back. An employee at the salon, which also doubles as an art gallery and frame shop, told Trent that no such magic potion was available. At this point, cops report Trent became belligerent and created a disturbance inside the business. He was subsequently arrested on a misdemeanor disorderly conduct charge. Trent, whose hair color is listed as bald, I put as hair color transparent. In police and jail records, was booked into Shelby County Detention Center. In an unrelated case, Trent, who remains behind bars, is facing charges for arson, criminal mischief, and violating a protective order. Cuckoo in the nut.
You know what my grandfather would have said? If you would have walked in and he would have... No, that's the other grandfather.
Okay.
My grandpa Dennis, if you would have came in and he was the barber on duty that day, and you would have said, I need something to grow some hair on my scalp, he would have went out back, found the biggest cow pie he could have found, and he would have slapped it on your scalp, said, just let that sit there for about 2 to 3 days. And
laughed his silly ass off about it for years.
Yep, and said maybe something will grow out of that there patch.
Convicted felon whose alias is listed as Bud Light Mike in police records was arrested Saturday after allegedly stealing a case of, believe it or not, America's favorite beer, court records show. According to Florida police, Mike Filipkowski swiped 24 cans of Bud Light from a Publix supermarket in Treasure Island. Filipkowski, 51, was subsequently arrested after being found in possession of 21 of the purloined cans. He downed 3 cans, lickety-split, Tim. Since Filipkowski's rap sheet includes multiple prior theft convictions, he was charged with a felony theft count. He is locked up in county jail in lieu of $2,000 bond. That's the most expensive 3 Bud Lights ever.
But he doesn't have a problem.
Nope. An arrest affidavit lists the New Jersey native's alias as Bud Light Mike. Court records reveal how Filipkowski, seen at in this picture, earned that handle. In April, he was convicted of stealing a case of Bud Light from a Wawa convenience store in Clearwater. He has twice been convicted of carrying an open container of Bud Light. He also has been convicted of stealing 2 18-packs of Bud Light from a Speedway store. Filipkowski was convicted after he could not pay for a Bud Light at a hotel bar. Filipkowski's rap sheet also includes convictions for trespass, drunk driving, battery. Here's my thing. Your Honor, please, if it pleases the court, I'd like to approach the bench. Defense Attorney Dave Schrader. Your Honor, please look at the records. Please, if you could, Your Honor, could you indicate for me, what is this man known as?
Why, it says here Bud Light Mike, Mr. Schrader, but what is your point?
My point is this, Your Honor. Could it be that after years of being told this, you are Bud Light Mike, this man is not confused. He's convinced. His name appears on the can. Your Honor, you and I work in the law system. When we go to our fridge in the break room, do we not grab the bag with our name on it? And do we not eat from that bag of contents or drink of that drink?
Right.
This man known as, I'm sorry, what did you refer to him as, Your Honor?
I said Bud Light Mike.
Exactly, Your Honor. He was not taking Captain Morgan's, Your Honor. He was not even taking Budweiser or Coors, nor did he take Stroh's or Hams. Your Honor, could you please tell the court, if it pleases you, sir, what did he take?
Why, he took Bud Light.
Who took that, sir?
Bud Light Mike.
Your Honor, I think we should throw this case out. Dave Schrader, defense attorney at law.
He's been struck upside the head by entitlement.
Right. He's not confused. He's convinced. He's not a convict. He's convinced, Your Honor. Set this man free. Thank you. Thank you.
You're getting the slow clap here.
I like it.
Yeah.
Slow clap, fast clap. I'll take it.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think? I think I got it. Listen, they're referring to him as Bud Light Mike.
Yeah.
There is that sense of entitlement.
There is. Yeah.
All right, Timothy.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to power through this because why not? This is the top 10 world's dumbest criminals. Criminals, criminals, criminals. According to the article that I've got here.
Okay.
Below the top list of the 10 dumbest criminals of the world for 2020.
Hmm.
Albert Bailey is going down as one of the stupid. Well, should I go from 10 up or 1 to 10? They show it 1 to 10 going down to the biggest number. Should I count up? I don't know how this is written, so I don't know if number 1 is just kind of, oh, he's a pretty dumb guy. Number 10 is really stupid. Mm. Yeah, we're going to go that order. We're going to go in the order the article was intended, Tim.
Okay.
Albert Bailey. There's no doubt that this criminal, Albert Bailey, is one of the world's dumbest criminals. This man and his partner plan to accomplish a mission that was for bank robbing. In this case, it seems that they didn't plan anything or haven't done any stealing before, even an ice cream, Tim. They didn't even stoop to trying to steal an ice cream or candy from a child first.
Huh.
Here comes the funniest moment. These two robbers called the bank before they entered to tell them they're coming to rob it.
Hmm.
Well, here, Your Honor, they are responsible. They knew that there could be dangers, Your Honor, in innocence being a part of that bank robbery. So they were doing their best to clear the area. So who's the real criminal, Your Honor? These two gentlemen or the bank for not pushing everybody else out before they got there? Something to consider. Something to consider. I mean, what could be funnier than this incident where the bank's employees know that the robber is on their way and they have enough time to call the cops? The incident took place in Connecticut, and according to the thieves, they warned the bank, so bank got threatened and collected the money for these two robbers in advance. They were just trying to streamline the situation, right? They're thinking, Tim, because this is social distancing at its best. These are robbers who complied, Your Honor, with trying to avoid as much human contact as possible, allowing for the money to be put in bags and handed to them before they arrived, Your Honor, so that nobody would possibly pass disease.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a sensible mind for these two talented robbers. But after a few minutes, Bailey sent his partner into the bank with a note to tell them that these are the same robbers who just called. Later, the police handled the situation, and Bailey, along with his partner, among the world's dumbest criminals, got arrested and charged with first-degree robbery and 9 years in prison.
Whoops.
Wah, wah. Darren Kempton is our next one. Burglar found the perfect house for a robbery in this case, Tim. A criminal's main aim is to find the perfect spot in which he can execute his robbery, planning, and the same this dumbest criminal did, Tim. That's the way this is written. That was poorly written sentence structure. Yeah, instead of finding the right house to rob, this man invaded a house full of police. And that's how he handed himself over to the police without any trouble. Hmm. The man named Darren Kempton from Abington, Northampton, entered the house at night that was already burglared earlier that night. So there were police officers for investigation purposes. And at the same time, Kempton broke in again. Of course, he tried to run immediately, but it was not that easy. And he was caught at the spot. The burglary was unsuccessful. And from that time, he comes as one of the world's dumbest criminals. Before entering the police house, he tried to invade another house, but unsuccessfully. And then left marks of his blood on that window. So the cops easily linked him to that case, too. And now you can imagine the face of the dumbest criminal at the time being caught up by the cops, Tim.
Hmm.
Sorry, this article must have been written by an eighth grader or in a foreign language trying to loosely translate it. Here's our next one. This one also comes from the world's dumbest criminals, probably due to being less present at the time of the robbery. Yeah, that's right. This dumb man entered a bank, and there he threatened the target with a real gun. This robber was with a gun and a bag in another hand. This goofball told the target to fill up the bag with 700,000 pounds in cash.
Hmm.
That's a denomination for those of you that don't know. He was in Britain, so he's looking for 700 pounds, which is $700,000. Instead of giving him the bag, the douche handed over the gun to the target. And probably he was under pressure because, you know, robbing a bank, Tim, it's not like eating cake. Sometimes you're kind of worried and stressed. So he says, I need you to fill my bag, $700,000 in cash, and then pushes the gun over to the teller instead of the bag.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
Stressful situation made this mistake, and after a few seconds, the robber realized his mistake, but it was too late for him. Unlike the robber, the worker was in full presence of mind, and he took full advantage of the situation by then pointing the gun straight at the robber's face. Hmm. Didn't your mom tell you it's never a good idea to point a gun at somebody? Who's the real criminal, Your Honor?
Right.
He was passive. He's like, listen, I've got a gun. I'm not going to use it. I'm just going to push it over to you. Can you just give me $700,000? He was asking, Your Honor, is there a rule? Contend, Your Honor. Is there a rule where you cannot walk into a bank and make a request for $700,000? Some people refer to it as a loan. But if it is a non-contractual loan and I simply ask for the money and place a gun on the counter, I push it to you, and I hold open a bag, Your Honor, I'm complicit in the fact that I am not here to hurt you. I just want $700,000. As a matter of fact, it could be said, could this not be a barter situation, Your Honor? Perhaps he gave the gun as collateral.
I'll go one step further.
Your Honor, if it pleases the court, my junior assistant would like to step forward. Tim Dennis, defense attorney at law in practice. Please step forward. What have you got to say, sir?
Your Honor, the accused is a nonviolent criminal. So therefore, holding a gun is against his beliefs. Therefore, mm-hmm. he pushed the gun across so that said teller could hold himself hostage while he filled the bag. Do you see what I'm saying? So he said, kindly, could you hold this gun up to your head while you fill the bag full of money? The defense rests, Your Honor.
However, the next part, Your Honor, we cannot defend. The robber ran away without the money, but he wasn't empty-handed as he pedaled off on an employee's bicycle. We do plead guilty in that case, Your Honor.
Yep, we'll take that.
He asked for no more than 32 years for pedaling off on the bike.
32 years?
I'm trying to be, aware of the other situation. One of the most important parts of doing a robbery, according to this number four, Dennis Hawkins being the criminal in question, one of the most important parts of doing a robbery is to hide your real identity or face and go ahead with a fake look that no one can identify. But this man is one of the world's dumbest criminals who took help of a fake identity, but he did not use it wisely. He needed a good disguise so no one doubts his identity. But Dennis Hawkins seemed weak in hiding his real face and picked up a blonde wig, fake breasts, and clown pants. So this look got easy for police to find. Because, you know, he's walking around in a blonde wig and clown pants.
Yeah, I call that Friday's look, actually. Yeah. Yeah.
He said he was just fooling himself. He wasn't fooling anybody else in his attempt to look like a woman. He didn't even get rid of his mustache and goatee that made him finding his exact identity through CCTV cameras a little easier. Police released his getup to the entire city. And meanwhile, a gas station attendant informed police about the strange look trying to steal a car. Later, police found him in his red pants and identified that it was, in fact, Hawkins. And here he comes. He's one of those top 10 stupidest criminals. I don't know that I'm buying these so far. I hope they're getting better.
Yeah.
As we go. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like this one, though. This is these criminals made an ass of themselves. Literally, Tim.
Literally.
We're going to Colombia.
Okay.
This robbery was a height of dumbness. So the writer of this article contends to put both criminals among the world's dumbest criminals. He said they also deserve a trophy. Robbers always look for the secure way so they can get away from a target place as soon as possible. But these two robbers appear to be out of their minds, and it seems like they weren't in any real hurry to get away. The robbers underestimated the most important aspect as the least important, and they did the robbery successfully, but their getaway vehicle was a 10-year-old donkey. Not a bike, not a car. They had a donkey that they could load up with their ill-gotten gains. Even the donkey was not their own. They kidnapped it and loaded all the robbery on the back of the donkey. In the robbery, there were food and rum, and they loaded and planned to escape. Fortunately, the donkey was wiser than the two closed-minded criminals, and he started making noise. Listening to the noise, officers came and identified the entire situation. Meanwhile, both robbers ran away, leaving the donkey behind and all the stolen food and rum. Maybe, Tim, these two guys were being held hostage by said donkey. And the donkey's like, you're going to go in there, see? You're going to get me some rum and you're going to get me some food. And if you don't, I'm going to kick you. Have you ever heard of a donkey punch? You're not going to want one, son.
Ooh, donkey punch.
Our next story brings us to Zachary Tentoni. Zachary Tentoni.
Yep.
When it comes to robbery, nothing should be left behind, not even a fingerprint. But this robber didn't know about this simple rule, and he left behind his certificates as a great proof of his identity. So again, put amongst the world's dumbest criminals. Robber grabbed the wallet from a woman and ran away, but he left his important things behind, and one of those was his birth certificate. The wallet was filled with $40 in cash and the victim's ID, but the robber dropped his two important things, a birth certificate and his mother's letter. These two proofs of identity were enough to identify him as Zachary Tentoni from Southington, Connecticut. In no time, police caught up and identified the situation, even after his pretending to be somebody else. The pretending thing was pointless because there was the victim who identified him immediately. And this dude's got like super bugged out eyes and a Mo Howard haircut. So it's not like you could not recognize. But I'm going to give you, I want you to take an image, take a look at this guy, Tim.
Okay.
Is what I'm saying.
All right.
I want you to look at this face and say, would you recognize him in a lineup?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I would. Yeah.
Hey, Mo. Number seven. It is said that you have to offer something delicious to your opponent to set up the trap, and the same trap was used by the Derbyshire police to catch criminals. Police caught 19 criminals by offering a crate of beer to each one of them. These cops were undercover and taking full advantage of it. They spread this news of winning a crate of full beer. They also informed that an individual has to contact the company, and that was the time when a rat entered the trap seeing the cheese, Tim, or in this case, the beer cheese. 19 of the criminals were called, and they were set up by police, and they had to come in to collect their winnings, which in case was a form of beer. It was a crate of beer. After reaching the spot, there was no crate or any offer. The police officers were all waiting for these bad guys to show up. These fellas deserve being in the list of the world's dumbest criminals who easily got into a trap and were arrested because of their foolish brains and succeeded with the sting operation named as Rocky. They named the sting operation Rocky. I don't understand the connection, but I'm not here to judge. Ruben Zarte is our number eight, Tim, in this list of 10. He's the next one in the list of world's dumbest criminals because he crossed all the limits of insanity. This robber, who was an 18-year-old at the time, named Ruben Zarte, invaded a muffler shop located in Chicago. He then demanded money by showing up with a gun and waving it at the staff. The staff got threatened, but there was a problem. They couldn't give more money to this robber as the manager was not there and all the money was in the safe that only managers could open. The brilliant robber left his phone number, so when the manager came in, the staff could call him so he could come back for the cash in the safe. Finally, we're getting into truly dumb criminals, Tim. But it was his bad because the staff first called the Chicago Police Department and told the entire story and how it happened. The robber thought it was wise to steal the money next time, but he was unknowingly made, the silly little mistake. It's a little mistake, really, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Could I just, here's my number. Give me a call when your manager's in so I can finish up the robbery. I got to go pick up my McRib anyway, so
let's just
do this. Yeah. The robber felt he had left it in good hands. He wandered back to the store when they called to say the manager was there. He tried to run away, but there was a brief shootout, and he ended up getting arrested, Tim. Manga. Undoubtedly, this is number nine. He undoubtedly falls among the world's dumbest criminals as he didn't choose his spot wisely. The man was planning on stealing a car. It all went wrong when he found out U.S. Marshals and state police detectives were in that car. As you can guess, the next step, the thief was arrested. This attempt was made in 2012. Oh, why is this even part of the article? These are supposed to be the dumbest criminals from 2020, Tim. This author of this article is starting to irritate me. So let's just go to number 10. Daniel James Bradley, the dumbest Spider-Man. Yeah, I hated all of his movies.
Yeah.
A man attempted snatching a woman's purse while wearing Spider-Man's costume so no one could identify him. After he got caught by police, he said that the costume was used as a disguise. Really? Interesting. He's not just one of the world's dumbest criminals, but a piece of shit who tried to make robbery in the name of Spider-Man. That's what the author of this article says. At last, he was treated like a criminal while stealing from a 24-year-old lady. The robber was Daniel James Bradley, 22. He tried to rob the lady in her parked car when he walked towards her, dressed as Spider-Man. Bradley, the thief, came with some planning as he was in a jacket worn over his Spider-Man suit. So, you know, cleverly concealing his secret identity, Tim. When the lady started screaming for help, he panicked, tore off his jacket, and raced down the street in his Spider-Man suit, where he was easily spotted by the police. Mm. I would have just said, I'm trying to catch him, Your Honor. Mm. I'm on the run, trying to catch him. I get nothing.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. That's it for this week's Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals, folks. Tune in tomorrow to Darkness Radio for Supernatural News, Parish Share. We hope that you'll tune in and enjoy that. We'll be back again next week with more of the best in true crime talk radio. For that guy, I'm this guy. You've been listening to that show. This is True Crime Tuesday.